Morning, everybody. Now, should have a PowerPoint. There we are. And make sure this thing's operating. Yeah. Okay. Here we go. All right. So, if you have ever at all ever tried to share the gospel with a non-Christian here in Australia, sooner or later, someone's going to say to you, the Bible has been changed over the centuries. Even if the Bible were true when it was written, it's been copied over and over and over again, copied and recopied and recopied for thousands of years. One copyist makes a mistake, the next copyist makes two mistakes, the one after that makes three, and they all copy each other's mistakes. And century after century, all of these errors add up until we get to the point that we have no idea what the original said. Let's have an example. Mark 1:1, the beginning of the gospel about Jesus Christ, the Son of God. Pretty important. Pretty important. In your Bible, you've probably got a footnote there that says, some manuscripts do not have Son of God. You've seen these kind of footnotes in your Bible? Uh-oh. So we've got some ancient manuscripts that say, Jesus Christ, the Son of God, and some that say, Jesus Christ, and that's it. What are we going to do with that? What did Mark originally write? Did Mark say Jesus is the Son of God and some later copyist removed it? Or did he not say Son of God and some later copyists added it? Neither one sounds too good, does it? This could be a big problem for us. We're doing a series of messages on whether Christianity is true. What did the original witnesses say? Can we trust them? So for today, how about this question? What does it matter what the original witnesses said if we don't have what they said? What does it matter if we can trust them if we don't have the original versions of what they wrote? Has the Bible changed over the centuries? Well, to start things off, in one sense, the answer is yes. Yes, scribes did make mistakes copying the manuscripts, and yes, sometimes they even made deliberate changes. But that does not mean that we are completely in the dark about what the originals said. How do we figure out what the original reading was? Well, it's not random. We don't just roll the dice. We don't just flip a coin. It's also not arbitrary. We don't just pick and choose what we want the Bible to say. I believe Jesus is the Son of God, but that is not a good enough reason to say that Mark said Jesus is the Son of God in Mark 1:1. It's not random, and we don't get to just pick what we want the Bible to say. How do we do it instead? There is a whole science, in fact, called text criticism or textual criticism. This is a very important science for all kinds of ancient literature, not just for the Bible. But if you were to go and buy a copy of Homer's Iliad or Plato's Republic or any piece of ancient literature that was copied by hand, somebody had to use the science of textual criticism to find out what the original said. Any document that has been copied by hand will have some changes creep in, usually accidents. In fact, it is not just ancient literature, but even more recent things like William Shakespeare's works were copied by hand. They need to use textual criticism to uncover what he originally wrote because some of the manuscripts of his plays and so forth say different things. There's a rational process for figuring out the original reading in any piece of writing where there are differences in the handwritten copies. Now, what we're going to do today is get just a little peek of this process. Some of you are going to think that this is too academic, but please, honestly, if you just listen today, this will be good for you. It will. This is important stuff. This is important stuff, and it will enhance our witness to the world around us because you will be challenged with this if you try to share the gospel. You don't need to memorize everything that's said today. All I want is for you to relax and get a picture of how reliable the Bible is. Is that fair? All right. I thought so. And this won't be anything like a university lecture. This is just the very, very basics, but it should be enough to see how reliable the Bible is. So if we have manuscripts that say different things, we need to consider two lines of reasoning, two kinds of evidence. And the scholars call it external evidence and internal evidence. Now, don't get alarmed. Don't worry about the scholarly terms. It's pretty simple. External evidence and internal evidence. What's internal evidence? It's stuff that's inside the text itself. What's the actual wording of the manuscript? How does it compare to the wording of the other manuscript? And so on. External evidence is outside of the text itself. It's questions about which manuscripts say what things, how many manuscripts say them, where did those manuscripts come from, and how old are they? That kind of question. So internal evidence is talking about what's in the wording of the text itself, and external is about the kinds and numbers of manuscripts that support each reading. So, speaking about manuscripts, what manuscripts and sources do we actually have for the Bible? Our four main sources for the Old Testament are the Masoretic Hebrew text, and for a long time that was our only Hebrew source. But we were able to supplement it with the Samaritan Pentateuch, for example, and the Septuagint, which was a Greek translation of the scriptures made a few hundred years before Jesus. So these are very important sources. We've got other sources. We've got Latin manuscripts, Syriac, Aramaic manuscripts of the Old Testament. But those were the main three. And then, of course, in the middle of the last century, we found the Dead Sea Scrolls. And everyone's heard of those? All right. You can't overstate. That's what I'm going for. Sorry. Thanks for your patience. Thank you. You can't overstate the importance of the Dead Sea Scrolls. It's tremendous. Even though they are around 1,300 years older than the standard Masoretic text, they are very, very close in wording. Sometimes you'll hear excited Christians say that they agree 100%. That's not true. We don't need to spread falsehoods to bolster our faith. They are, however, extremely close. For 1,300 years of hand copying, the Dead Sea Scrolls have demonstrated that our Hebrew text is quite accurate. In the New Testament, we have got nearly 6,000 Greek manuscripts from various times and places. That's a lot. Nearly 6,000. Some of them are quite complete. Some of them are just fragments. But the average of those 6,000, the average Greek manuscript is about 400 pages. So it's a pretty good size. In addition, we have got about 10,000 Latin manuscripts and nearly 10,000 manuscripts in other languages like Syriac and Coptic. So right there, you've got 25,000 manuscripts for the New Testament. But we've also got ancient lectionaries. Do you know what a lectionary is? So a lectionary was a collection of readings from the New Testament, generally, for festival days and holy days. The churches would read a specific text on Pentecost or on Palm Sunday. And so a lectionary was a collection of those readings. So that's an ancient witness to what the New Testament said. And we've also got very important source is quotations of the scriptures in the early church fathers. And some of these go all the way back into the second century. So we have some very ancient witness to what the New Testament said. If, for example, Irenaeus quotes from the Gospel of Mark, we can see what his text of Mark said. Does that make sense? Very important. So how do we use these sources? That's getting at the question of this external evidence business. How do we use these sources? We need to ask questions like this. If we've got a manuscript that says one thing and another manuscript that says another, We're going to ask how many manuscripts agree with each one. In general, all other things being equal, if more manuscripts agree with this one than this one, this has a better chance of being right. That makes sense, doesn't it? All right. If we've only got, if we've got a reading that only one manuscript has, and all the other 29,000 manuscripts say something else, then that reading is probably wrong. That's a pretty rational decision, isn't it? It's not just flipping a coin about what the Bible said. It's not we're completely in the dark. There's another important question, and that is how ancient is the support for a reading? If this manuscript says one thing and this manuscript says something else, but this one comes from the 2nd century and this one comes from the 12th century, then all other things being equal, we're going to trust the 2nd century manuscript. It's just common sense. The earlier the manuscript, the less chance there is that changes and errors have crept in. Okay? Now, we can't apply any of these rules mechanically, but in general, more manuscripts is better evidence, and older manuscripts is better evidence. But we also want to ask, how widespread is the manuscript support geographically? This is a pretty important one. If all the manuscripts that say a certain thing come from one place, but the rest of the ancient world has manuscripts that say something else, then the one in that one place is probably an error that somebody made there, and it was copied there. Does that make sense? So how widespread is the support is an important question. And then you also need to ask, and this is more for the professionals, how reliable are particular manuscripts or families of manuscripts? So the scholars spend a lot of time in these manuscripts, and they have come to know some that are more reliable and some that are less reliable. And they know some that are reliable in certain ways, but less reliable in other ways. And that's just a matter of their experience as professionals handling these documents. But they've got to weigh that up as well. So that's external evidence in a nutshell. It's about factors that are outside the wording of the text itself. The number of manuscripts, their age, their quality, and so on. Now, the really fun stuff for me is the internal evidence, because I like looking at the actual text of the Bible. I hope I'm not alone in that, being in a room full of Christians. Internal evidence, the actual wording of the text. So when we're comparing manuscript A that says one thing and manuscript B that says something else, our key question here is which reading makes best sense of how the other one happened. If A was original, can we figure out how B happened? How to describe accidentally create B if A was the original reading? If that's not clear what I'm getting at, we'll look at a few examples, just a few, and they come from the Gospels just for convenience. So Matthew 14:24. This is the story. What's the story here? Jesus walking on water. Yes. I just thought I'd give you a pop quiz there. In the story of Jesus walking on water in Matthew 14, verse 24 says the boat was already a considerable distance from land. Seems pretty straightforward. However, some of our manuscripts say the boat was already in the middle of the lake. Not a big difference in meaning, is there? You're not going to lose any sleep over this one, are you? But it's worth asking, how do we know what Matthew originally wrote? How do we decide which one is probably correct? Well, here's the missing piece of the puzzle that helps us figure it out. In Mark 6, when he's telling the same story, he says the boat was in the middle of the lake. Now, why does it matter what Mark said if we're trying to figure out what Matthew said? Because it helps us answer the question, which variant reading in Matthew best explains how the other one happened? So if the original said in the middle of the lake, exactly the same as Mark's gospel, there is no reason why a scribe ever would have changed that. That doesn't make any sense. If Matthew had written in the middle of the lake, nobody would have invented this completely new reading, would they? If, however, Matthew originally said a considerable distance from land, then it makes perfect sense that a scribe who knew Mark's gospel and was copying Matthew's could accidentally have written the wording that he knew in his copy of Matthew. Does that make sense? Oh no, is there a misspelling? Someone's just going to have to tell me once clearly what it is. Okay, yes, and I'm glad you pointed that out, because that happens a lot, actually. The scribes did that too. I'm in good company. New Testament scribes often accidentally doubled a word. Thank you, John. I did it on purpose, actually. Where were we? So if a scribe knew Mark's gospel already, and he was copying Matthew, and he's reading along, the boat was already, and he writes out the middle of the lake, because that's the version he knows already. In fact, the scribes did this a lot. It's called harmonization, because they harmonize one text with another. And the vast majority of these cases are simple accidents. It happens a lot with all kinds of books in the New Testament, in fact, but especially with Matthew, Mark, and Luke. The scribes will often be familiar with one of those and accidentally put the wording of one of them into another. So harmonization is a very frequent cause of variance in the manuscripts. Here's a different kind of copyist mistake. This one's a lot of fun. Okay. Somehow we're all the way back at the beginning of my thing here. It's in Matthew 15. This is the story of the feeding of the 4,000. Have you ever noticed how anticlimactic the feeding of the 4,000 is? You've already had a feeding of the 5,000. You'd think, you know, you'd go up and it would be more impressive the next time, but it goes down to 4,000. Interesting. I'm actually just trying to fill time as I get here to Matthew 15. 38. I'm pushing the exact same button. Is there anything we can do to get back on track? Is there any way we can get back to... It should be slide number 14. All right. I'm not going to mess with this. Can I rely on you? All right. Woo! So, feeding of the 4,000, Matthew 15. Did verse 38 say 4,000 besides women and children, or 4,000 besides children and women? Again, does this affect the meaning of the verse much? Clearly not. But this is a good example of a typical mistake that a scribe might make. Which did Matthew originally write? Well, just like in English, saying women and children was more natural in Greek than saying children and women. And so, if Matthew had originally written women and children, there is no reason a scribe would have swapped that around. It doesn't make any sense. However, if Matthew had originally written children and women, then it makes perfect sense that a scribe would smooth that out accidentally. It makes perfect sense that as he's copying from one manuscript to the other, he would write the more natural word order because that's what would come to him. And I think, although almost all of our manuscripts say women and children, I think that children and women is the original, and that not just one scribe, but several scribes accidentally swapped that around. Okay? It's the most likely explanation of the evidence, and it's clearly just an innocent mistake while copying. It's not some sinister plot of heretics to change the Bible or anything goofy like that. So, in addition to harmonizations, another common error by scribes is to make awkward readings smoother, difficult readings easier. And that means that when we're trying to figure out what the Bible originally said, we should normally, all other things being equal, prefer the more difficult reading. So skeptics think that we just pick and choose what we want it to say. In fact, in this rational process of reconstructing the original, we typically pick the verse, the wording of the verse that's going to make life harder for us, because it's more likely that that's the original one and someone smoothed it out later on. Does that make sense?
All right. Won't always be the case, but it's often the case that the original reading is the more difficult. And there are other kinds of errors that are in the manuscripts. You get spelling differences. You get changes in word order. One letter gets mistaken for another. Yes, you get extra words sometimes. And sometimes they'll accidentally skip a word. Have you ever been reading, and maybe you read up to the word and then your eye accidentally skips to the next line down where the word and shows up again? Okay, a few people are nodding their heads. Happens to me. I'm glad I'm not the only one. It happened to the scribes as well. Of course it did. So, when you're looking at the details of the different readings, you can normally figure out which one is probably original, the reading that best explains how the others came about. Now, armed with what we've learned so far, let's come back to Mark 1:1 in the next slide. So, did Mark call Jesus the Son of God in his first verse or not? Well, think about this. If Mark did not say Son of God in Mark 1:1, why would a scribe add it? I don't know. Maybe he felt it was a better title. After all, Mark calls Jesus the Son of God about 8 other times in his gospel. So maybe a scribe thought this was a better title. But if Mark did write Son of God, why would a scribe remove it? Because he's a heretic who wanted to deny that Jesus was the Son of God? Of course not. Otherwise, he would have removed the other 8 times that Jesus is called God's Son in Mark. So he wasn't deleting it because he was a heretic. Is there a reason that we can figure out why it might have dropped out by accident? On the next slide, don't be too frightened. You don't actually need to know Greek to see the point here. But these are the 7 words of Mark 1:1 in Greek. And you can see that every single word except for the first ends in exactly the same way, the same 2 letters. And by the way, that's not pronounced oi, oi, oi. That's pronounced, I should ask one of the guys that's doing Greek, Paul? Ooh. Close. Ooh, ooh, ooh. Sorry, Paul, I shouldn't have put you on the spot. But you failed the test. Oh, man. Oh, man. Pretty good. I'll remember that. So every word, except for the first one, you got 6 words in a row that all end in exactly the same way. This makes it very, very, very possible that a scribe who's looking in a dimly lit room at one manuscript that he's reading and moving over to the next manuscript that he's writing, and possibly he's already just copied the whole Gospel of Matthew and he's a bit tired, he comes to Mark and his eye goes to the wrong ooh, and he skips a couple of words. Those last 2 words mean Son of God. So this makes it highly probable that what we have is just an accidental omission of a couple of words. So next slide. So we have a good explanation for how Son of God could have been dropped if it was original. And also the external evidence for including Son of God is pretty strong. So on balance, I think we can very safely say that Mark originally wrote the beginning of the gospel about Jesus Christ, the Son of God. But what if he didn't write Son of God at 1:1? Would that matter much? No. On the next slide, Mark repeatedly calls Jesus God's Son. It is all over his gospel. If he didn't say it in 1:1, all that means is he didn't say it in 1:1. And not only does Mark repeatedly say Jesus is God's Son, but the rest of the New Testament says it in dozens and dozens of places. There is no doubt that our earliest witnesses believed that Jesus was the Son of God. So next slide. Has the Bible been changed over the centuries? When we started this morning, I said that in a sense, yes, it has been changed. And now I'd like to finish by saying, in a much more important sense, no, it has not. We can be very confident that our Bibles accurately reflect the original writings of Scriptures. In the first place, on the next slide, we've seen that there is a rational process. There's an entire science called textual criticism, and that was only the tip of the tip of the teeny tiny tip of the iceberg about what this science looks like. There's a whole science for figuring out what the original said. We are not floundering in the dark about what the Bible said. In the second place, on the next slide, there are, in fact, relatively few variants in the Bible. Skeptics like to say how many thousands of changes there are in the manuscripts. That's only because we have so many manuscripts. In fact, very, very little of the text of the Bible is in any doubt whatsoever. Considering how many thousands and thousands of manuscripts we have, of course, there are a lot of variants in those manuscripts. But most of those variants, on the next slide, the overwhelming majority of these variants are completely trivial. Let me ask you, do you spell John's name with one N or two N's in the ancient world? Who cares? Who? They didn't care. The same author could spend, he cares, but you wouldn't have cared 2,000 years ago writing your name in Greek. The same author can write the name John in three different ways in the same book. They didn't care. And so if you've got a manuscript that spells John with one N and another manuscript that spells it with two N's, it doesn't matter. So we get spelling differences, changes in word order, completely innocent harmonizations, and obvious scribal mistakes. And you probably thought that my examples this morning were a bit silly. Women and children, the boat in the middle of the lake. But this is exactly what the great majority of manuscript variants are like. Completely trivial. This is what the skeptic is getting so worked up about. And on the next slide, it's a fact that most of the variants are pretty easy to explain. In fact, the goofier, the more wild, the more different a variant is, the more likely it is that we can figure out that it wasn't original. It's not like it was even possible. You get these goofy theories about ancient heresies that went around and changed all the manuscripts all over the ancient world. Not possible. You couldn't. I mean, how, logistically, would you actually go around and get every physical manuscript all over the ancient world? How could you even do that and change them all, and then the next day people wake up and they read their scriptures and it says something different and nobody notices? It doesn't make any sense. I'm getting off track here. But most of the variants are pretty easy to figure out which is the original. And then on the next slide, what we end up with is very, very, very few manuscript variants which are truly significant, meaning that they both make a difference to the meaning of the text and require some more effort to figure out which one is right. Very few variants are truly significant. I've seen estimates from 1% to 5% of the text of the New Testament is in any real doubt whatsoever. Now, what are some of those major variants? I want to quickly show you a few, just so that no one can say I'm hiding anything from you. These are some of the most serious textual variants in the New Testament. These are the big ones. How serious are they? Did Mark's gospel end at 16:8 or at 16:20? Or is the original ending of Mark's gospel lost? My personal view, most scholars would disagree, my personal view is that when the gospel of Mark was published, it originally ended at verse 20. I think the long ending is original. But you don't really lose anything. I'm not going to lose any sleep over finding out that actually it ended at verse 8. It's not that big a deal. If you want to talk about this one or any others, I'll be here at 7 o'clock as usual tonight. And we've got a little group that likes to discuss and get our Bibles out. So we can talk about any of this stuff if you're interested in more information. But there's no faith-shattering difference where Mark's gospel ends. How about that story of the woman caught in adultery? I think, in my personal view, it's very clear that this is original, that this is meant to be there in John's gospel where we find it. Again, most scholars disagree on this one, and I'd be happy to talk about the details of it. But what have we lost if they're right? We've lost a really nice story, but it doesn't teach us anything much different from what Jesus taught when he said, "Do not be judged, lest you be judged yourselves." Does it? We haven't lost any cardinal doctrine of our faith if I'm wrong and this story is not original. There is a proof text for the doctrine of the Trinity in 1 John 5. I think it's extremely clear that this half a verse is not original to 1 John. It's not. But that does not raise any doubt whatsoever about the doctrine of the Trinity. Sometimes your King James only folks will point to this one and say, "See, the modern Bibles are trying to deny the Trinity." But if you actually read a modern Bible, you still got Matthew 28, you still got Jesus' baptism, you still got 1 Corinthians 12, you still got the Trinity up and down the New Testament. That half a verse has very little claim to being original, and I think it's not. But that doesn't affect our faith at all. We have dozens of proofs of the Trinity. Did the Ethiopian really confess, "I believe that Jesus Christ is the Son of God," before his baptism? Just like Mark 1:1, it doesn't matter that much. The rest of the book of Acts and the rest of the New Testament says Jesus is Son of God. The rest of the book of Acts and the rest of the New Testament says you have to believe in him to be saved and be baptized. This is not a problem. Did Jesus sweat drops of blood in Gethsemane in Luke 22? Well, no major truth of our faith hangs on that either. Some of our manuscripts say that. Some of them don't have those couple of verses. And I'm not going to lose any sleep over that one either. And these are the big ones, folks. There are some other significant variants, but these are the serious ones. These are the longest ones that affect the most content of the New Testament and could be claimed to affect some serious doctrines, but in fact they don't, because there's always support for those doctrines somewhere else. So I've shown you some of the minor and easy variants, and I've shown you some of the major and difficult ones. And again, if you want to talk about any of those, come along tonight. I'd be happy to do that. Now, here is the single most important thing that I'm going to say today. This is the one point that if you ignore and forget anything else I've said, this is the one that I want you to take home and take with you when you're sharing the gospel about Jesus Christ with other people. If somebody says to you, "The Bible has been changed over the centuries," the most important thing that you need to remember is that no textual variants in any of the thousands of biblical manuscripts ever raise any doubt about the gospel message that's at the heart of our faith. None. Jesus Christ is Lord and Savior. He died for our sins, and he was raised to life again. And all the witnesses say that in every copy that's come down to us. Turn to Jesus as Lord, and you will be saved. Reject Jesus, and you will not be saved. There is no doubt whatsoever about this central gospel message. So, on the next slide, what can we say in conclusion? First, if you are not a Christian, don't let this be your excuse for not accepting Jesus. He really is Lord and Savior, and that has not changed over the centuries. You should either find a better reason to reject Jesus, or even better than that, stop rejecting him. Acknowledge him as Lord today. or at least come and talk about it. It won't kill you. Second, if you are a Christian, don't let a skeptic scare you by claiming that the Bible has changed over the centuries. You don't need to memorize everything you heard today. I just want you to see how secure the Bible text actually is, so that you know you can put your confidence in it. If a non-Christian says the Bible has changed over the centuries, you know you have nothing to be afraid of. So start gently asking some questions. Ask them, what do you mean it's changed over the centuries? Listen. Ask them, how do you know that that's true? Let them explain it to you, because you know that they can't back up what they've said. Maybe you can help them see the truth about the reliability of the Bible and its witness to Jesus Christ, the resurrected.